in regards to the DC consultation that, I mean, just ended like minutes ago, or if that, if there are counselors in DC who are participating, if we know that they're on and who they are, so that they're accounted for within the
Deborah Hughes joined
the attendance.
Sure. So what you're suggesting is that we ask them to let us know if they are there in D.C.?
I was just concerned if they may not be connected separately, if we'll know that they're there or not, or just making sure.
Okay, yeah. No, it's a good point. Glenn, I think I heard that the recording started. Is that correct?
Yes, this conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time.
Yes,
okay.
Thank you. Provision is being made for the counselors in D.C. Craig Schwartz will be there and is looking after the connection. And Christina will be a bit late on the call, I think, due to that very reason.
So should we, I guess since we have a quorum, we'll go ahead and start and they'll jump in and hopefully let us, we will know when they jump in.
I'll let you know when they jump in, Chuck.
Okay, thank you very much. I don't want to delay the call for everybody else because of that, because we do have a quorum. So let's go ahead and start. Glenn, would you please do a roll call?
Yes, certainly. On the call, we have Chuck Gomes, Caroline Greer, Adrian Kinderis, Tim Ruiz, Stefan van Gelder for the contracted parties house, and for the non-contracted parties house, we have, sorry, I missed Terry Davis, who's also for the contracted parties house. For the non-contracted parties house, we have David Taylor, Wolf Ulrich Snowben, Jamie Wagner, Rafik Damak, William Drake, Deborah Hughes, Wendy Seltzer, Olga Cavelli, and we have apologies from Zaid Jamil and from Mary Wong. For our liaisons, we have Alan Greenberg from the ALAC, and Han Chan Gui has sent his apologies. And for staff, we have Denise Michel, Julie Headland, Tina Dam, Liz Gasper, Rob Hogarth, Marika Koenig, and Glenda Sangerie, and Christina Rosette has just joined the call. Thank you, Chuck.
Thank you, Glenn. And welcome to everybody, and a special welcome to those of you who, for whom it's late at night or in the middle of the night. We appreciate you joining us at the poor hour. Glad that doesn't happen every time for you now. So
Edmund Chan has just joined, Chuck.
Thank you. Any updates to statements of interest? Any comments, questions, or amendments to the agenda? Okay, and then the minutes of our last meeting on 17 December were approved according to the rules of the new procedures on 31 December 2009. So if there are any, everything should be okay with those. If there are any comments or questions, you can always put them on the list. Going to item 2 of the agenda, the issues report regarding vertical separation of registries and registrars, and that's a topic that will be, maybe it's already started, I don't know, in D.C., and is one that's being talked about there. Kurt, as you can see in item 2.4, we'll talk a little bit about that once they come online. So first of all, note there's a link in item 2.1 to the issues report on vertical integration. And at this time, Margie is Margie on? Because she may not. Is she in that meeting in D.C.?
Is indeed.
She,
yes,
is indeed. So we may have to move on from item 2 and go to item 3, because I'm assuming they're not on yet. Is that correct?
Okay. Craig Schwartz has just joined.
Okay.
Okay, this is Margie. We're actually on now.
Oh, you're on. Okay, very, very good timing. We're on item 2 of the agenda, and it's on the top, the issues report of vertical integration, vertical separation or integration of registries and registrars. Margie, if you are prepared, we're ready for you to give an overview of the issues report. And for everyone's reference, the link is provided for that issues for her overview on item agenda 2.2.
Okay, can you hear me okay?
I can hear you.
Excellent. I'm going to provide you a little overview of the issues report on vertical integration. I invite all of you to read the document. It's fairly long, and this is going to be a very cursory review of the main issues. The first thing we talk about in the issues report is the scope and the possible outcomes of a PDP. And as is required by the Annex A, we go through an analysis on whether or not a PDP on vertical integration would be within the scope of ICANN's mission and the GNSO mandate. And we do take the we do have the opinion that it is within the scope of the ICANN mission, and it's also within the scope of the GNSO mandate. However, we wanted to point out that although it may be in scope, there are limitations within the registry contracts that may affect whether or not there could be a binding consensus policy that would affect existing registries. And so part of the issues report talks about the contract language and whether or not this issue could be addressed through a consensus policy. From the GNSO's perspective, if the goal is to adopt a policy that would be broadly applicable to both existing GTLDs and new GTLDs, this may be a concern because it may end up that the outcome of a GNSO policy would be merely a recommendation or a best practice that ICANN should seek amendments of existing agreements to conform to the policy. So, in other words, there may be a situation where existing GTLDs may operate under different rules than new GTLDs. But we're not ruling out the possibility that there could be a consensus policy altogether. It just simply depends upon the specifics of the proposed policy. So, for example, if an outcome of the PDP would be something like addressing an issue related to warehousing or some other aspect that may be implicated by vertical integration, it's possible that there may be a consensus policy coming out of that. This issues report is unique because it addresses an issue that hasn't come up recently. And the question really is, once a policy is approved, can its implementation be stopped by a related PDP? And we take some time in the issues report to really discuss this issue. And the way we look at it from the ICANN staff perspective is that since the outcome of the PDP is uncertain, both from the GNSO and the board, it has been ICANN's practice in the past to wait until its adoption to implement it. In other words, if a PDP was launched on this topic, we wouldn't stop any implementation work going on with the new GTLD process. We would simply continue to operate until there was an outcome from the PDP process and a board approval. And so so that is our past practice. And the way we look at this is that if it were possible, and we wanted to highlight that if it were possible to start a PDP and that would somehow hinder implementation of an existing policy, that might be problematic, and we don't see any support in Annex A of the bylaws to allow that type of effect. Now, we also talk a little bit about effect of a PDP on the current implementation process. And I thought it would be useful to give some background on the new GTLD policy.
Margie, before you go on, I want to interrupt and ask Craig if the participants from the D.C. meeting are all on board now. And can they see? Are they? Can they see the Adobe Connect screen?
Chuck, we have Margie in the room, also Kirk Pritz, Dan Halloran, John Jeffrey back in a moment, and myself. And John Jeffrey's not coming to the meeting. And
okay. Any counselors in the room?
No.
Okay. Yeah. Just wanted to update. Thanks, Craig. Appreciate that. Oh, sorry, Margie, but I just wanted to confirm that.
Sure. And also, there's no one else in the room. It's just us.
Okay.
So to provide some background on the new GTLD policy, the GNSO approved the policy in September of 07, and the board approved it in June of 08. And as staff, we were directed to develop an implementation plan with community input for board approval. And that's the process that Kurt is supervising, trying to get community buy-in on the various proposals to deal with the implementation issues. If a PDP were launched, it would not stop this process because it would actually be contrary to the board's instructions to staff to continue developing the implementation details. One particular aspect of the policy recommendations that were approved by the GNSO are also implicated here. There's this recommendation 10 that indicates that there must be a base contract provided to applicants at the beginning of the application process. So the way we look at that recommendation is that if there were a new PDP policy approved by the GNSO, should it actually launch a PDP, if that wasn't done before the first round of applications, we might end up in a situation where there would be one registry agreement that would apply to the first round of applications. And then if there was a policy that somehow changed those rules, you'd find a situation where subsequent rounds would be affected by it. And so I just wanted to highlight the possibility that counselors understand that there may be differing standards that would apply to applicants in earlier rounds versus later rounds. I also touch upon the historical role of the GNSO Council on vertical integration. Because this was raised in the statement submitted by the NCSG. And one of the suggestions was that somehow if we were to continue dealing with this through the implementation, that this would somehow be contrary to the ICANN bylaws. And so we took a look at this to make sure that was not the case. Historically, this issue has been dealt through procedures outside of the GNSO. There is no prior policy recommendation on this issue. It was not addressed when the GNSO developed the initial GTLD policy, although it certainly could have been. Our perspective is that if a PDP were launched now, it may be too late to really affect the initial round of applications. And so that theme is carried throughout the report, because we are trying to find an appropriate forum to address these issues before the new GTLD first round takes place. So historically, the current practice that has been adopted by ICANN has varied over time, and I spend a bit of time talking about the historical framework and how the contracts have changed. In the past, these changes weren't done through the GNSO process and did not require GNSO approval, but were actually done through the renewal or rebid process with each of the registries. And so we believe that continuing to resolve this issue through the implementation process is consistent and appropriate and would actually be the most effective and timely way of dealing with the issue. We obviously think it's important for the GNSO to provide input and to submit comments and do whatever the GNSO thinks is best to affect the implementation process, but we feel that a formal PDP is probably not the way to go, and that is our recommendation, to delay a PDP at this time and to find an informal means of providing input through the implementation process. So we also talk about in the issues report the options for the GNSO to consider in deciding whether to commence a PDC at this time. And some of these issues that I think some of these themes are addressed in with respect to other topics as well. For example, bandwidth concerns. I think we're going to talk about this today on the GNSO call. We are concerned that with this particular issue that it may have an adverse impact on the pending GNSO priorities and projects, and we're worried about the types of commitments that from volunteers in launching a PDP on this topic at this time. And so that's why, as staff, we're encouraging the GNSO to consider a less formal approach to provide timely and more effective input to the implementation process. You know, this could be something like coordinating responses to future comment periods or to even, you know, develop additional implementation guidelines. But the idea being that if you do something less formal, you may be able to provide input in a quicker manner that will help, you know, guide ICANN before the launch of the first round. Our recommendation is to delay the PDP for, you know, 1 to 2 years in order to gather data on the initial distribution model that is actually adopted to see if there is a way that GNSO policy could help promote competition. And I wanted to point out that we're not, in the issues report, we've specifically not made a commitment to adopting one model versus another. That the issue of which distribution model should be adopted is still open, and that's the subject of the work that Kurt Pritz and the services team is working on. We're simply saying whatever the distribution model is, when it is adopted, you know, we'll recommend that we take 2 years to see how it impacts the marketplace and whether there are specific policies that could be adopted to address specific concerns that might surface, you know, after 1 to 2 years. And the idea being that a future PDP could focus on specific rules to address that conduct that's causing the harm. So if it's a warehousing issue or if it's something else, that might be something that could be more appropriately addressed once we have some statistics and information on whether there's been harm in the marketplace. Okay, and I think it would be best now to open it up for questions.
And before I do that, let me point out, and I think everybody is aware of this, but I just want to make sure that there is no action on this decision today. We don't have any motions on the table with regard to this. The intent is for us to act on our January 28th meeting with regard to whether or not to initiate a PDP. At the same time, we can talk about that as much as people want to. As everyone will recall, in our 17th December meeting, Bill Drake shared with us that the NCSG anticipates coming out with a statement in the near term here in this regard and indicated that they wouldn't be ready at this time, and there seemed to be a general consensus that later January would be better to act on this decision. And in fact, the motion that we passed on 17 December said that we would act on it in January, not specifying which time in January. That said, let me take a cue. And let me look over here at the okay. Wendy, it looks like you're in the queue, right?
Yes, please. So a question for Margie. Why it sounded as though you were equating policy development process with slow and with intent to delay the new GTLD process, even if it couldn't actually do that, and informal consultations as somehow fast. So is there a reason that you think that the policy development process needs to be slow? And on the converse, are there sort of actual demands that anyone can make in an informal process?
Sure, I can respond. PDPs don't have to be slow. I'm just making a realistic assessment based on, you know, facts from past PDPs. I think even this morning we were talking about the fastest one we'd seen recently was the domain tasting, and that took over a year. So it takes a while to get the policy developed and then to develop the implementation details to launch it. And I'm just, you know, being realistic here that I understand the council's concern about wanting to provide input and just highlighting that if you want to affect it early on the schedule that is being pursued for the new GTLD program, that you may be more effective in addressing it through an informal way. I think that the PDP processes need to be updated, and we're working on that. And one of the things we need to address in the working group is to come up with rules to have expedited PDPs, but we just don't really have that yet.
Did that answer your question, Wendy?
Well, in part, and I think the other piece was part of the policy development process is to work through consensus of quite a disparate group and also to request information from outside sources and from ICANN staff. And I wonder a little bit how either of those things, the consensus gathering and information gathering, would be done in an informal process, or would that just be sort of those who are loudest get heard there, but not the entire council?
Did you want to respond to that, Margie?
I guess I don't really understand the question. Obviously, through Kurt's work, and Kurt can talk about what the next steps are on this topic, you know, there's a lot of community dialogue. Just today there was a meeting here in Washington, D.C. on this issue, and public comments are always considered and summarized and, you know, and addressed. So let me hand it over to Kurt and see if he wants to comment.
Hi, everybody. This is Kurt. So I'm going to report more fully on the results of the meeting today and what was discussed. Later on in this agenda, I think you know, for us the and for the new GTLD team's work, certainly not Kurt's work, is that there's been a lot of discussion on this issue. That there was more discussion today, and you know, I don't know the exact timing of what's moving forward. I wouldn't be surprised if the board wants to discuss the status of where we are at its next board meeting, and you know, certainly we want to propose a model for this in time for the next version of the applicant guidebook. If, you know, all these issues are sort of tied up together, but if it is decided by the community and everyone to go ahead with the EOI process, we'll want to settle in some form and have a model for registrar separation posted so that people will know who can apply. So I think, you know, the timing of this is to have registrar separation model posted in the next couple months. And then, you know, then after all this community discussion, it might be fairly close to bake, but of course it's all still for public comment.
By the very nature of an informal process like the issues report recommends, obviously it kind of, Wendy, I think it does obviously leave the door open. It's not as well defined as a PDP and so forth, and GNSO involvement is certainly more undefined. It depends how active and organized we are in the comment process. So I think your question is very valid. But we probably have a certain amount of control how active we are involved in that process. I believe probably what your concern is that we don't have a determinative say in terms of the final recommendations in that regard like we would have with regard to recommendations from a PDP. Let's go on to Mike.
Okay, Chuck. I'm just trying to understand where staff feels like it gets the authority to make a recommendation that's quite different from existing registry agreements when there was nothing in the GNSO Council's new TLD recommendations to suggest that staff should do such a thing. And now you come back to us and say that if we try to give an opinion, a formal opinion on it now, it's going to delay things, but it seems to me that your logic is that if we impose a policy that wasn't in place in time for this next round of TLDs, then future TLD applicants would be disadvantaged. That logic seems to me to apply precisely to the existing TLDs we have today, which, according to the proponents of change in the model, are suffering from the vertical restrictions. So to me, it seems like the issue is inextricably bound between existing and future TLDs. If it takes a little time to figure it out, I guess that's too bad. But meanwhile, there ought not be any change to the existing restrictions. That's the BC's position. And the question, I guess, for staff is where they think they get authority to recommend changes to the existing policies.
Someone from staff like to respond?
Sure. I mean, I can respond. The GNSO could have adopted a policy that addressed specifically the vertical integration issue for new TLDs. It didn't do so. And so in developing the implementation plan, there's all kinds of details that need to be resolved in order to launch the program. Effectively, you can't do a new round without some sort of distribution model. So you needed to have a model proposed, and what staff is doing is really just a practice that's part of an implementation plan and is not a policy. When we think about the difference between a practice and a policy, it's an interesting question. And the question really is, are you trying to adopt something that's universal across all TLDs for all time? And trying to adopt a one-size-fits-all approach. That's typically what the genus of council policies seem to address. What we're doing here is not that at all. It's simply a distribution model that is necessary to be decided before the program can be launched. And this doesn't stop the GNSO from developing a policy later on. It's just simply dealing with the reality that in order to implement the GNSO policy that recommended new GTLDs, that there must be a distribution model. So I don't know if that answers the question.
But we have an existing distribution model today. Council didn't recommend that it be changed, yet staff, based on staff's own unilateral inputs, is deciding that there ought to be a change.
The question really is, what is the status quo? And we spend a bit of time in the issues report talking about that there really is no status quo. The contracts vary quite a bit. And so, I think it's difficult to say that there's one standard approach that ICANN has taken on this point. And I don't know if maybe Kurt wants to comment on this.
Kurt?
Sure. I think that, there is no staff proposal yet, so there is no change yet. And certainly what the discussion has been input to staff on this issue. So there was input to staff to undertake an independent economic analysis of this issue before making any proposal, and so that was done. And then since then, nearly all parties that I can tell that have participated in this discussion, there's a few exceptions that I admit to, but almost every party would like to see the 15% limitation removed from the agreement for new GTLDs. So whether or not that becomes part of the proposal yet is not determined, but it's not the staff idea to remove that. But even in the debate format in Seoul, all, you know, both sides of that party advocated for that position. And then, well, that's all.
Now, I think that, and correct me if I'm wrong, Mike, but I believe Mike asked a question with regard to authority to make a change. Does anybody on the staff side want to comment on that?
Yeah, hi, Chuck. This is Dan Halloran. I'm here with Martin.
Thanks, Dan.
I guess just I'd question the sort of premise that this is a change. I mean, what Margie's saying is that the status quo is more complicated. We can't just say there is a current policy, and if Mike thinks there is a current policy, I don't know where it's written down or how it was developed. We do have most of our current contracts have a provision that says the registry operator can't acquire more than 15% of the registrar, but that was never developed through a policy process, and it's not enshrined anywhere as policy, and we've had contracts in the past, and we have contracts today that don't include that provision. So it's not a current policy that we're proposing changing, and we're just trying to come up with a provision in the new contract that's going to apply to a radically different circumstance than we have today and in the last 10 years, which is starting with just one and then, you know, a handful of GTLDs, and we had, you know, certain requirements and distribution models, and now we're moving to, you know, possibly hundreds of GTLDs, and we're trying to come up with a new contract that works. And we're hearing from, you know, economic experts and participants, and they're all recommending all kinds of different things. I don't really hear any of them saying we should keep the status quo or whatever. I've never heard a coherent explanation of what the status quo is exactly or how you would apply that existing supposed status quo to a new situation where you're changing the status quo and adding hundreds of new entrants. And so I guess there's no easy answer to it, but that's kind of what was laid out, I think, in the issues paper.
Okay, before moving on to Christina and Stefan and Caroline, Mike, did you have any final comment?
I do, but I'll let it go for now. Thanks.
Thank you, Mike, and thanks everyone else for participating there. Christina.
Hi, Happy New Year, everyone. I have a few questions, and I think I'm hopeful that some of them are just because I'm missing something. The first one is that if I am understanding correctly, the staff recommendation is that we should delay or at least not initiate a PDP at this time because the implementation efforts are underway because those implementation efforts are ongoing and it's likely that the PDP won't be completed before the new GTLD, the first round of new GTLD round opens, that as a result, you'll essentially potentially have a scenario where you've got kind of existing registries under their restrictions, potentially another set of restrictions for first-round GTLD applicants, and then for second and subsequent rounds, a completely different set of potential restrictions depending upon if there's a PDP and what the outcome is. Is that, am I summarizing that correctly?
Yes.
Archie?
Okay. Here's my question. How is delaying a PDP going to change any of that?
Exactly. Delaying the PDP isn't going to change that, but what it will do is allow the council to evaluate the actual harm in the marketplace, if there is some, and to deal specifically with the actions that occur, you know, that seem to be problematic. So in other words, right now we're kind of shooting in the dark. Nobody really knows what's going to happen, what different models are going to be out there, what's, you know, appropriate or inappropriate action. 2 years from now, you'll have launched the program. You'll have some statistics or some information about complaints, about some bad actions, and then that might be something that could actually be addressed through a consensus policy. So it may not necessarily be ownership issue, but it might be, you know, warehousing or whatever the issue is that that happens to be causing trouble in the marketplace. So it's really a reason to delay in order to get information on what kinds of harms are out there.
All right, and I guess my second question goes to that concept, and I apologize, I can hear an echo, but I'm not on speaker and I don't know what to do differently. I guess the concern that I have is that I could, let's just assume for purposes of discussion that the council decides not to go forward with the PDP at this time and we wait, then we identify what the competitive, the harms are in the marketplace. And setting aside for the moment the fact that you could potentially have some pretty significant consumer harm, which at that point you can't go back and undo. You've got people who've set up business models and will have to completely change how they do business. I'm concerned that we're going to find ourselves in a situation where, okay, fine, we identify specific harms, we develop consensus policy to remedy those, and then it turns out that we're essentially playing whack-a-mole with the smaller issues, where the big issue is the vertical integration itself. And I just have a real concern. It really goes back to my first question. If we sit back and do nothing now, arguably we are creating a situation where harm does occur, and there's nothing that can be done at the time to rectify it. And what I'm wondering is, at what point do we as counselors, given the emphasis on the public interest in the AOC, do we have an obligation to really focus on that as well?
Thank you, Christina. Stefan.
Thanks, Chuck. Am I on?
You are.
Okay, great. I just had a couple of follow-up questions, first of all, on what Kurt said earlier on. Kurt, I thought I heard you say that this issue needed to be resolved before an EOI model could be accepted by the board. And am I correct in did I hear you correctly saying that?
Sure.
I'm talking about the separation issue, not the specific PDP.
Right. So obviously, whether or not we're going to conduct an EOI is still up in the air, and if we do, the terms of it are still up in the air. But the model that was posted suggests that certain issues should be settled, such as who can apply for TLD and what they can apply for. So we think that it makes more sense to have the issue in at least a version of the guidebook that's fairly well settled before we launch the EOI. And so that is why the posted model suggests that the EOI not be launched until we post the fourth version of the guidebook.
And that's consistent with the GNSO recommendation regarding the communications period, that, you know, things be fairly, very firm before you start the communications period, and the AOI, as it's proposed right now, would, in fact, before people could decide whether they're going to apply or not, would need to have a firm picture of what the conditions are, including this particular issue.
Could
I remember, Stefan?
Well, I remember Kurt saying at our last meeting that this specific issue, because it might affect who could apply, there would be a provision, what was being proposed in the EOI model, and remember this meeting was before the EOI model was actually published. But Kurt said that there would be a provision for people who, if the separation issue went one way and they ended up not being eligible to apply anymore, they would be able to drop out of the EOI and not forfeit their money. So am I to understand that now what's being said is we don't want to get into that situation, and so, you know, we will solve these issues at least before we start an EOI, which in my mind pushes the EOI sufficiently back that it's actually almost a moot point, because the final guidebook will be out a couple of months afterwards.
Kurt, do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, so I think what Stefan's saying is, except for the moot part, I think what Stefan's saying is pretty much on the mark, that at least in the draft model, and so it's not what Kurt said, is essentially that we really want to settle as many of the outstanding issues as possible and leave whatever open issues there are down to a few, and
hopefully non-important issues, like you were saying, Chuck, and that so therefore refunds would be let out in a fewer number of circumstances, which I is intended to create more certainty for those who are considering to participate. But I think I'm not necessarily a proponent for or against EOI, but I think the timing of it as proposed doesn't take away from its meaningfulness.
Okay, let's go on to Caroline, and after which it'll be Adrian.
Thanks, Chuck. Margie, thanks very much for your presentation. It seems for this report that staff is really setting out its stall as regards integration, and it seems that there's a desire to do to allow vertical integration for new GTLDs and then do a PDP further down the line to sort out any issues or problems. And I'm kind of torn on this one because, you know, I certainly appreciate the desire to move ahead and not cause any delay to new GTLDs, but the problem I see with this strategy is once you're into integration and you're in there with 2 feet, you know, I think it's going to be very difficult to step back from that and to turn your back on integration, and whatever model, you know, of integration takes, I think it's going to be really hard to turn away from that. Is that something that, you know, is that a problem that you see yourself, or do you genuinely think that that is something that, that could be done?
Someone from staff want to respond?
Sure, I guess I can respond. I think if a PDP were launched later on, as I indicated earlier, it would be a best practice or a guideline for ICANN to try to adopt those provisions with the existing registry agreements or the GTLD new ones that have launched. There may be a situation where you won't get the optimal uniformity that you may be looking for, but I think you're already in that situation because of the timing of the implementation work. One thing that may be helpful, and it's something we talked about this morning, was the ability to amend registry agreements later on in the process for dealing with that. And that might be something that we might want to give some thought to, because this might be an example of an area where you'd want to take advantage of an amendment process to be able to try to bring in existing agreements, with the, whatever policy the GNSO Council might come up with.
Now,
yeah,
because I don't want to spend the whole time on this topic, I'll let you come back, Caroline, just 1 second. The whole meeting on this one topic, and it is a very important topic, so I don't want to minimize it in that sense, but I'm going to cut the queue off in a little bit. I have Adrian and Tim in the queue. If anybody else wants in the queue, either raise your hand or let me know right now, and then we'll move on. But I it's going to be really important that we try as much as possible to continue this discussion on the list between now and our 28 January meeting, because there are lots of issues with this. It's not simplistic by any means, as we all know. So does anybody else want in the queue right now? I don't see any other hands up.
Chuck, can you put me in again, please, Stefan?
Okay. And, okay, thank you. Then I'll close the queue on this one unless there's a response on a specific topic that's raised by the other speakers. Now, Caroline, coming back to you.
Go ahead, Chuck, in the interest of time. That's fine. Thank you, Margie, for your comment.
Okay. Okay. Adrian.
Yes, thank you. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Yes. I just want a clarification from Kurt, because the dialogue between him and Stefan kind of confused me a little bit. Are we saying that the EOI can or cannot go forward until vertical separation is dealt with? Because it was my understanding that it could go, and that if it impacted, then those who had EOIs in could get out. I just wanted clarity, because I think that ultimately, if the answer is if it cannot go forward, then and if we're talking about a year for a PDP, and potentially that's been the shortest PDP we've had, and I know that's mere speculation, So we're effectively saying that the EOI process could not start for a year. So can I just get clarification on that, please?
Yep, Adrian. Yes, Kurt. Thanks, Adrian. It can go ahead. There's a model posted for public discussion right now. It's one of the most interesting questions associated with it beyond whether we should do it or not. And so it'd be interesting to hear what the public comment is on that issue, which is an issue discussed a lot before a model was developed and continues to be. So it's kind of a close call. So
let me share a personal observation in that regard, Adrian. As long as this is, again, my own personal opinion in terms of understanding the recommendations of the GNSO with regard to new GTLDs and my understanding of the EOI as proposed right now, as long as the EOI has a requirement that says that you have to participate in the EOI in order to apply later, I think to be consistent with the GNSO recommendation that before you start the communications period, everything needs to be in place or all substantive issues need to be in place, that you couldn't start the EOI as long as that requirement's in there, because otherwise you would start your communication period at a point where there's some big unknowns left, and that was something that would have gone contrary to what the GNSO intended in its recommendations. That's my personal opinion. Tim.
Thanks. It sounds like what I'm hearing, and I think, giving some thought to it, I think it makes some sense, and maybe all of us should consider it a little bit more deeply or thoughtfully, and that is that regardless of where you come down on the vertical integration issue, that the problems that it could potentially create, or at least the kinds of problems that I hear as potentially being created by it, don't need to preclude vertical integration necessarily in order for them to be resolved. And so it's not a matter of if integration is allowed to some extent or to some limited degree, that later the problem is we can't undo it. I don't think it necessarily has to be undone, but policy and even consensus policy might be able to be implemented to address the problems that it created or that gets created through it. And in reality, I think at least as I consider some of the problems, it seems to me that those things could become issues even without integration, given that registries and registrars can cooperate today without necessarily being affiliated in a technical or legal way. So I don't think that the integration is really the issue. I think it's kind of a misnomer, and it's more some of the problems that it could cause should be more of the focus. But given where we're at and what staff is telling us and the likelihood that we're going to get a PDP done before some decision is made about vertical integration and how that's going to go forward, just one suggestion might be that we backburner a full PDP, but maybe focus more on what input could the GNSO pull together, or how could we work together in a more quickly and timely fashion to provide input into the process while time remains to influence in whatever way we can. And that might be something more practical to consider and still consider the PDP for later, whether it's 2 years down the road or a few months after the DAG is final. But at least that would be something that we would be able to perhaps come together on and have some input on in a timely fashion that would actually make some difference. And then just one final thing about the EOI that kind of came up, and that is that, it isn't just a matter of, solving the integration issue. Can there be integration or not as to whether you want to apply or not? It's the conditions around it. So, if there's integration but a registrar can't offer a TLD in a registry it's affiliated with, the registrar could still apply. Would they get a refund if later it's refined a little, and the conditions around what they can or can't offer makes it unpalatable. You know, would they be able to withdraw their application or not complete a full application and get a refund of their EOI deposit? So I think there's a lot of little details around that issue that need to get resolved, not just the major question itself.
So, Tim, am I understanding that you're – and by the way, I appreciate your constructive approach to trying to problem solve here. Are you suggesting something maybe along the lines of an IRT for this issue or something like that? And forget about all the details of the IRT as far as makeup and so forth. An expedited process that might pull some of these things together?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Otherwise, I don't think, you know, it's going to – sounds like a decision is going to be made, something's going to go forward and be done, and that might be a way for us to have more constructive input.
Thank you, Tim. Stefan.
Thanks, Chuck. I'll make it very brief. I think Tim's just made an excellent suggestion in terms of, you know, throttling back a bit and maybe trying to work through this in a constructive way. I felt, and maybe it was just me, that some of the comments made after Margie's report was published and after the presentation she made kind of implied some suspicion of staff. You know, why are they suggesting that there's no PDP, as if there was a hidden motive? That's just me. I felt that maybe no one intended or meant that, but I certainly didn't feel. I think the report is. I feel that there's been an honest attempt to try and get as many of the facts out as possible, and there's a recommendation in there which does seem to make some sense. It doesn't say never do a PDP. It says, you know, the current situation may not be right for doing one right now. I think that's something we may want to you know, take a close look at. Thanks.
Thank you, Stefan. And I'll end the queue on this part of this topic. It's not over with yet, as you can see by the agenda. Kurt, it's your turn again to talk about what happened today in D.C., if you can do that.
It was cold.
It's about... There were 70 here where I'm at.
Yeah. So there were three agenda items discussed. The process for amending the and they all had to do with the proposed registry agreement that's posted as part of version 3 of the guidebook. The meeting was really born out of a discussion that was held in the registry stakeholder meeting in Seoul, where we were discussing the proposed registry agreement. There was considerable discussion about the process for amending the agreement. And that's the third guidebook, I think, was the probably the fourth iteration of a process for amending the agreement. But nonetheless, a vigorous considered discussion. And so during that Seoul meeting, we committed to having a intersessional face-to-face meeting to discuss that topic. So we took nearly a full day from 9 to 3. The meeting was, the RSVPs were 30-some-odd people here in Washington, D.C., and another 60 or so by phone. I'm kind of looking at Craig to see if he knows any actual numbers, but he's not saying anything. So... we discussed, and it was a broad-based participation. So, you know, many registry, GTLD registries and registrars, but also members of the IP constituency, the business constituency. I think somebody from at large, some from at large were on the phone, and I'm leaving somebody out, but. There was fairly broad-based participation, and we discussed three agenda items. One was the process for amending the registry agreement in accordance with our commitment. The others were vertical integration of registrars and registries, or vertical separation. And the third was the pricing for registry services, how the price a registry charges a registrar. which gets passed on to the registrant for a domain name. And so, very briefly, in the process for amending the agreement, we reviewed the basic concerns around that and the goals. And the goals that staff portrayed, anyway, were that, whatever process there was for amending the agreement needs to be pragmatic in that, you know, we're changing our environment from several registries to several hundred, perhaps, in the longer term. And we needed to be able to administer that in a fairly economical way, which leads one to the conclusion that there should probably be one or very few registry agreements. Second, that we take into account the public interest, and that is that, any process for amending the registry agreements should serve the benefit of registrants and users. And third, that the process for amending a registry agreement have certainty, and that is these new GTLDs are independent businesses, and in order to invest in a business and plan sufficiently, you need some degree of certainty as to how and when the agreement might be amended and in what ways. And so the discussion went around that, and there were several, leaving the past suggestions or recommendations behind, there were some suggestions on how there might be a process to amend the agreement in a timely manner that got away from the idea that ICANN might be suggesting amendments unilaterally, and they had to do with either a regularly scheduled meeting. It could be, one suggestion was once every 3 years, but it could be more or less often to consider the registry agreement and discuss changes and arrive at some recommendations that would then go through an appropriate public discussion and approval process. Or another suggestion was that a standing committee be formed that could take input and consider changes to the registry agreement. So it's not a staff committee, but one based more in the community or in the registry constituency. So there were some suggestions made, I think they were sufficient. I didn't caveat this, and Dan hasn't admonished me yet, but this is my stream of consciousness and rough note-taking understanding of what happened in the meeting, and we'll examine the transcripts more carefully and report on them. But to the best of my recollection, which is poor, we got to some conclusions where staff can now outline some options for consideration. We'll send them around, in advance to the group that took the time to participate in the meeting, but also share them with, publicly some optional models for considering changes, how to make changes to registry agreements. So I think that discussion was really good.
And so, Kurt, you kind of started to go this direction, but maybe you can get a little more specific for us with regard to next steps.
Yeah, so the next steps then, I'm pretty darn sure that we'll go back and create some alternate models based on the suggestions that were received to test that we understood what was being said. We'll circulate the models in advance to those that participate, but we'll circulate the models to everyone. We'll post them for consideration, and I'm not sure how they would get into the guidebook as a recommendation. They might they might be posted as a paper for discussion first or something like that. I'm not sure exactly how in what form we'll post them, but
so it could end up as an excerpt maybe before Kenya.
Yeah, so that would be the most concrete form of proposal. It'd either be some sort of explanatory memo or a white paper or or an excerpt.
Okay, thank you.
So I'm not done, Chuck.
Okay.
I just want to go over the other two items we discussed.
Oh, I'm sorry. I should have realized that.
Yeah, I'm talking too long, I know. We also discussed pricing of registry services and concentrated most. There was a lot of public comment about renewal pricing and that some measures be taken, that there be some price controls on renewal pricing in order to avoid predatory behavior by new registries that might want to engage in that. And it seemed like there was a lot of support for that still in this meeting. It became clear that the wording in the current draft agreement wasn't exactly clear, and there were suggestions for how to improve it. And so we'll have to go back to the notes and see how. There were several specific suggestions, so we'll have to go back through the notes and, amend what's in the agreement. But we've got to look at the public comment on Guidebook 3, too, but it seems like there was a lot of support for having something in the guidebook about price controls for renewal pricing. And then third, we talked about vertical integration of registries and registrars, and that was mostly to determine if there were areas of compromise or alternative solutions. We think that the debate format in Seoul was excellent for defining the issues, making them clear, and educating the community as a whole. But also the debate format, I think, tends to drive the sides of a debate further apart because the participants in the debate are advocating a position. So we wanted to have a meeting where we explored whether there were compromise positions in that or not. And there was some movement. You know, I'll have to go back and look at the notes. You know, this is going to be an area where there continues to be disagreement, I think. And I don't know exactly how we're going to publish the results or how a model might come out of this. I suspect this might be the board is interested in this topic too, so it'll be a continued discussion of topic at board meetings as they ask for a methodology for posting a model and then having discussion on a specific model. So anyway, the meeting was really good, and once again, the people that attended gave their time generously, and just about everybody sitting around the table, I think, participated in the meeting. And the after one fitted start at the beginning with audio, the remote participation was pretty good too.
Thank you very much for that update. I appreciate that. I don't believe that. Because a lot of things still have to be reviewed and so forth from that meeting, that it's necessary to open up a discussion comment on that right now.
Chuck, can I ask a question?
Go ahead, Stefan.
Please. Thank you. I just wanted to ask Kurt if there was, during the separation discussion, talk of the specific case that corporate TLD might represent. I mean, having a corporation that wants to run a private, completely closed TLD. Was that a discussion that was had during that meeting, or not at all? Were there any suggestions for dealing with cases like that?
Yeah, so there was discussion how a brand TLD might be the exception, fully vertically integrated with no restrictions. There was also some discussion about the difficulty of implementing such a new category, and I forgot what the last thing I was going to say. So there was that discussion. There was no discussion about the specifics of a model.
Thank you. And I see Caroline and Tim have their hands raised. Caroline?
I don't. I just can't figure out how to lower my hand. So.
Oh, Marie can take care of that.
Click on the same button that you used to raise your hand.
Okay. And Tim, were you in the queue? I guess not. I see yours is gone.
Oh.
Yeah, I forgot to lower it. Sorry.
Okay. All right. Okay, good. All right. So we're okay. And then there's obviously a lot more going to happen in this regard. So we will be coming back to that in the future. Now, last item then with regard to this topic on vertical integration is just a heads up. We will need to take some action in our 28 January meeting. That action can involve different things. It can be a motion to initiate a PDP and a follow-up motion to, you know, form working group and so on. It can be a motion to delay our decision further. It can be, you know, I'm not trying to prescribe what it should be, but we have committed to taking action in January, so we will have to do that. Now, that means that if people do have motions in that regard, that they will need to be submitted in advance of the meeting, at least eight days in advance of the 28th of January, so that would be the 20th of January. So I just want to give you a heads up on that. Any final comments on this topic before we move on? Okay. Then let's go to our next agenda item, which is the prioritization of GNSO work, and I'll turn it over to Olga for an update there.
Thank you, Chuck. This is very brief. We have been meeting with our working team every week on teleconferences. We have done a prioritization exercise among us using a two-dimension model with X and Y axis and their respective definitions. And we went through this process, putting priorities and numbers among ourselves. And now we're revising this result. So we'll still keep on meeting every week, and we hopefully will propose a methodology for prioritization of our work as soon as possible, maybe in a month, something like that.
Thank you, Olga.
I would like to stress, sorry, Chuck, that we have a fantastic support from staff, from Ken and Liz.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Any questions or comments on that? I don't see any hands raised, nor do I hear anyone. I am myself pleased with what's going on there. I think that there will be a proposal coming forward that'll be fairly complete for council consideration. Anything else, Olga?
No, thank you.
Thank you. So the next steps on that will be for the group to finalize a procedure that will be put forward to the council as a way for the council to prioritize. The group in itself, let me clarify, is not trying to do the prioritization of work tasks for the GNSO, but we are testing an approach before we propose it to the council among ourselves. So please understand that. That's an important distinction. And we are going to have a small group of two or three individuals that will red team our whatever recommendations we come up with for the council to consider. And Adrian has volunteered to head that up. So if there's someone that would like to be on that red team with Adrian, let him know, and let Olga know as well, who's the person that's leading this particular effort, and that would be appreciated. Okay, going on then to item four on the agenda, the Internationalized Domain Names Implementation Working Team Final Report, and there's a link to that on agenda item 4.1. And Tina Dam is going to give us a brief overview of that report. Tina, it's all yours.
Thank you, Chuck. So just a brief overview of the report, which is basically the findings of the report. So it's not even though I'm giving it to you, it's not a staff report, and it also certainly can't be considered final at this point in time. But the findings of the report is in the two different topics. One is for variant management, where it was found that variants can be requested and allocated to applicants. So if you are interested in a TLD and there is a variant TLD to that, you can identify it in your application and you can request it. It may be allocated to you if it fulfills all of the requirements and rules around it. and later on it could be delegated as well. But it can't be delegated until there is a method and a process available for that. Those are the desired variants. There are also undesired variants, and they need to be identified as well, and they will be reserved and blocked, so they cannot ever be allocated or delegated. Now, as I said, there are some rules set up in this report, and I can go through them in detail if desired, but let me just briefly mention the result of the report in terms of three character restrictions as well. The findings are split up a little bit. So first up is the two-character GTLD strings. And mind you, the variant subject is for both GTLDs and ccTLDs, whereas the three-character restriction is for GTLDs only. So two-character GTLD strings can be allocated if they follow a certain set of rules as well. Those rules are mostly associated with not being visually confusable to other TLDs. And then the other half of it is in terms of one-character GTLDs, which the team, the working group, found as a matter of policy, and so it has to be addressed by bodies such as the CCNSO and the GNSO. So with that, unless you want me to go into details, I'm just going to list some of the forward-looking actions. First of all, the report has been posted for public comments, and the comment period is closing tomorrow on the 8th of January. There's a couple of comments that has been included so far, and some of them has questions with clarifications or suggestions to broadening what a variant is, and we'll, of course, take a look at that. Number two, and that is in accordance with the report recommendation, is that ICANN should initiate a DNAME analysis to determine whether DNAME can be used for variant management. And that's a subject we've discussed for quite some time. Certain things have changed technically wise that may make it appropriate for that to be reopened and take a look at that again. Number three is, in terms of the three-character restriction, the report we think is so clear that we can make the two-character inclusion a part of the next version of the applicant guidebook. But in terms of the one-character registrations as TLDs, we need to do some more consultation with at least the GNSO. So that's pretty much the very brief overview of the results and what work is lying ahead of us. So, Chuck, I don't know if you want to go to questions or if you want me to outline in detail the rules that are included in the report for both variants and three-character restrictions.
Thank you, Tina. Well, first, let me clarify, and then I'll open it up for discussion questions, and if people want any of the detail, they can ask for it. If I understand the report, recommends that the GNSO and CCNSO do some policy work together with regard to two issues, the selection of scripts for which single-character IDN TLDs should be allowed and the method for allocation of single-character IDN TLDs. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Just wanted to clarify that now, and we'll come back to that in a minute as to how we might get started on that. But let me open up a queue. And again, if you're on Adobe Connect, please feel free to raise your hand in that regard. Any questions or comments on this? And while people are thinking, thanks, Tim, I'll allow another little bit of time for anybody else to raise their hand or speak up. Tina, is this work with the CCNSO going to require a great deal of IDN technical expertise, some minimal level? Do you have an opinion on that?
Well, I think, if you look at the report, it says that they don't – I can't remember the exact wording for it, so we may want to look that up. But as far as I remember it, they say that they don't believe there is a technical reason for restricting one-character IDN TLD labels. And that's where the question comes in, that what could work in one situation or for one script or language may not work for others. So I think there may be a little bit of a mix, probably some technical guidance, but more of some linguistic expertise may be more appropriate and necessary.
And some of that, and everybody on the committee wouldn't have to have linguistic expertise. Is that correct?
Right.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if it might be possible to set up some guidance or consultation, maybe.
Have an expert a part of the group. That could be handled. In other words, we're not looking for volunteers that would have to have all of the special expertise that's needed in it. The group, that could be provided for the group. I have Tim and Edmund in the queue. Tim, go ahead.
Okay, I think I answered my own question, but I'll go ahead anyway. I wanted to clarify that the variants being talked about in the report will only apply within a particular script. So if someone's applying for an IDN in Cyrillic, using Cyrillic, the only variants that they could really designate as desired or undesired would be variants of that IDN within the Cyrillic script.
I don't think that's correct. If you are a TLD and you want to support Cyrillic and you want to support Latin, you may have two or more tables, one or more with the Cyrillic characters in it, depending on what kind of languages you want to support under Cyrillic, one or more under Latin, depending on what languages you want to support under Latin. But because Latin and Cyrillic look so similar in some cases, they have several characters that look similar, it would only be appropriate to put cross-references between these tables so that you have the Cyrillic A would be a variant of the Latin A and so forth. Now, that is it's a slightly different way of dealing with things. And, for example, I think it would require that, you can't mix Cyrillic and Latin, so that's easy, so you're out of that. But if you have a string in Cyrillic where the entire string has all the characters in that string has Latin variants, then and that Latin domain name existed, then that Cyrillic string would have to be denied. So it's not just within one table; it's across them.
So for example, if .med, .med is applied for in Arabic as .Mediterranean, short for .Mediterranean,
mm-hmm.
can they then apply for .med in ASCII as a variant?
Yeah, okay. So it's because you mentioned Cyrillic, you got me off on a tangent.
Okay. Well, would that preclude, someone from later applying for .med in ASCII, for example?
Well, so that is not really, at least in my mind, and I don't know if there's any of my colleagues who wants to help out, but in my mind, that is not a variant question, because those two strings, the one in Arabic and the one in ASCII, are not variants per the variant definition as we have it. It's merely a translation. And then the question comes, how do you translate, and is there a pre-write for translated TLDs, or should it go to the same entity, or should it be blocked? And as far as I remember, the GNSO have said long time ago that there is no pre-writes, and you have to apply for it, and it doesn't block things out. But then I've been very focused for variants, and this is not a variant question, so I will stand to be corrected of any of my colleagues if.
In an orthographic sense, that kind of confused me. So
the example you have is not a variant in the definition that's in here. The example you're bringing up is similar to some of the examples that have been brought up in the public comment forum, and the suggestion there is to broaden the variant definition to include things like that. So as I said, this is not a final. This is a report made of some experts with some really good recommendations. It's not final, and we need to take a look at the comments, and carefully consider that, obviously. But as the report stands, your example is not a variant.
Okay, thanks.
Does that answer your question, Tim?
Yes, it does.
Thanks. Edmund.
Yes, I guess I just wanted to commend the great work from the members of that working team, and also Tina, of course. I'd like to congratulate ICANN for moving in the right direction for IDN, especially IDN TLDs. Not really a question, just really quite eager to move on to the next part of the discussion, which is the next step for following up with some of the remaining issues coming out of the report.
Thank you, Edmund. Not seeing any other hands raised or hearing anyone. One thing we do need is a few, I don't think it has to be a lot, but two or three volunteers who would be willing to work with some CCNSO volunteers to develop a draft charter for a group to work on the two issues that the report recommends. So I'd like to open that up now and then ask Glenn to follow up in this meeting with a request on the council list and to be passed on to constituencies and stakeholder groups and other groups in the GNSO for volunteers to be a part. Again, it doesn't have to be a very big group, but it'd be a charter is going to be needed for this work. It doesn't appear to be a long-term effort or a huge charter, but we do need a draft charter. So if we can in the next week or two get some volunteers, then I can communicate that with Chris Despain, the chair of the CCNSO, and we can go ahead and get the work on that charter started. Is there anyone that wants to volunteer for that on this call?
Chuck, this is Edmund.
Chuck, this is Tim. I'm not volunteering, just have a question. I want to get in the queue again.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. All right, you're in the queue. Edmund, were you volunteering?
Well, both.
I didn't understand you. Are you volunteering?
Both. I'd like to ask a question and also volunteer.
Okay, Edmund, go ahead with your question and then Tim.
Okay. The question is really two parts. One is I did hear Tina expressing maybe some sort of consultation or you know, I don't know how I guess Tina envisions whether a group would be formed between GNSO and CCNSO to address those issues, or whether she would like what the implementation working team, how it came together, that it's sort of a staff-led and, you know, put together, how that would work. The other part of the question is then, you know, if the joint group actually is appropriate in addressing these issues.
So are you asking in the latter question, Edmund, whether or not
whether the JIG is an appropriate group to follow up with those questions?
Yeah. Oh, so what you're asking is whether the JIG could cover these two topics?
Correct.
Good, interesting question. Tina, have you thought about that?
It is a good question. I'm thinking about it now, and I was going to ask Edmund if he could remind me how that group was formed. And is it GNSO and CCNSO? And I just can't remember.
Well, that group was formed between GNSO and CCNSO and to discuss and work on items of common interest on IDN.
Right, and you already have identified these topics as interesting for that for the JIG, right?
Correct.
So then it would be just a matter of modifying the charter to specifically include these two questions.
Right. I think one of the concerns initially between the group who wrote the report and the JIG was that they were overlapping a little bit. So if the JIG is open to taking up the parts of what came out of the report, the working team that we're looking at now, and not reopening the other questions. You know, maybe that would be appropriate. But I don't necessarily really feel like it's a staff decision.
No, I wasn't trying to put you on the spot in making a staff decision.
That's okay.
But just getting your input into the thought process that's going on right now. But do you see any problems with the JIG instead of forming? Writing a charter for a totally new group, it certainly seems simpler to me if we are able to incorporate these two specific tasks recommended in the report that you summarized into the JIG. That works a lot more effectively, in my opinion. Do you see any problems with that?
I don't see any problems in it, and that's why I mentioned that the JIG already have raised these topics as important issues for them. So if the JIG is open to taking in the recommendations and then simply work on the subject matter that the IDN implementation working team recommended and asked for, then I don't see any problems with that.
Now, Tina, I think I hear you talking about two different things. One of them is you're talking about the recommendations in this report, and the other one is taking on these two topics. Let's restrict it to taking on these other additional two topics first, and then we'll come back to the other one, because it seems to me that's a separate issue. Do you see them as dependent?
I'm not sure I followed you. I mean,
I'm asking is this: couldn't the JIG take on these two topics? Number one, selection of scripts for which single character ID and TLD should be allowed, and number two, a method for allocation of single character ID and TLDs. Couldn't they take those two topics on regardless of how they felt about the other recommendations of the report you summarized? I guess I'm not understanding why
I am now understanding what you're asking me.
Okay.
When you said the two topics before, I wasn't
fully
following you. I think they could take on those two topics.
Okay. And that's why
What I was trying to make a point across on was that I didn't want them to reopen the other recommendations, because I think we got, for example, a two-character and the way to deal with variants, I think we got very far with that, and I would hate that to be opened in a policy aspect.
I understand that, and from what little I've heard, and Edmund can speak to this better than I can, I think there is pretty good, that the JIG is probably on pretty much the same page, but I'll let Edmund address that. Now, Edmund, aren't you you're co-chair, right, from the GNSO side of the JIG?
Correct, and we're still waiting for confirmation for the co-chair from CCNSO. But I think on that particular matter, I think, Chuck, you're quite right, and Tina, you probably don't have to worry too much about it, because one of the reasons why the JIG has not completely formed yet is somewhat waiting on the report, and I think from early signs, I think it's somewhat safe assumption that we will work on top of, work with the report as a basis.
Yeah. Well, so if the GNSO is fine with that, I think that would be fine. I mean, it seems like unnecessary work to set up a new group.
Who's the staff support person or persons for the JIG?
I think both Glenn and Bart are.
Glenn and Bart, okay, good. So I guess the question then, Edmund, and we don't have to resolve this on this call and take everybody's time, but if you could work with Glenn and Bart and find out whether you think any amendment to the charter is even needed for the JIG to include these two, and then get back to the council list in that regard. If there's no action needed in terms, of even changing the charter, then that, again, makes it simpler still.
And Chuck, this is Tina again. We may want to add more staff support to that group, or at least we're going to have a quick conversation about who additionally may be.
Sure.
I don't see
any problem with that. Go ahead, Edmund.
No, I was just going to ask Tina to do exactly that.
Okay,
great.
And I see three hands raised here, Rafiq, Mike, and Bart. So maybe before going to Rafiq and Mike, Bart, did you? I used your name already, so maybe I should give you a chance to respond here.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Just a moment, please.
Bart, did you want to see?
I have children in the background.
Okay.
I just checked against the charter, according to me, but I need to check with the CC&O Council. There is no change needed. It's if both the CC&O and GNSO Council think this is an issue for which is relevant to both the GNSO and CC&O, it can be added to the working list of the JIG. So that's one. And secondly, I can confirm that Jan Zhang has been appointed co-chair of the JIG from the CC&O side.
Thank you very much, Bart. That's very helpful. Does anyone on the council, first of all, tell me if you object to me approaching it this way, and we can do it more formally if that's desired. But does anybody object to this approach of just giving these two tasks to the JIG group to do, and not forming a new working team in this regard to develop a new charter, et cetera? Any objections to that? Okay, hearing none.
Wait.
Then let me. I now have again have three people in the queue. I have Rafiq,
excuse
Mike,
me,
and Wendy. Did you object, Wendy?
Well, I put my hand up to ask a question that would determine whether I objected.
Oh, okay. Well, go ahead. Let me jump ahead to you in that regard.
And the question is simply, I don't object so long as the group is open to new members who have an interest in its expanded scope.
Yeah, I think that goes without saying. Any disagreement with that, Bart or Edmund?
This is Edmund. The charter itself has a particular number, but it also is open for the co-chairs to invite additional observers or essentially participants. So depends on how you view it.
That's right. The charter did require a certain number from the CC&SO and a certain number from the GNSO. Is that correct?
Yes, but what also was included, and Edmund is right about that, it is also include observers. And if it ever comes to a vote, a formal voting within the working group, that's where there is a distinction between observers and members. Otherwise, there is no distinction.
And how many and participants from each SO
five.
Are included?
Five.
And do we have five from each SO?
Yes.
Okay. Who are the five on the GNSO, Edmund?
I just want to add something before that. I Bart, if you can bring up the list, that'll be useful. But it's also important to note that the group is chartered to discuss matters and provide recommendations back to each particular SOs who would, you know, like for example for GNSO, then the recommendation will come back to GNSO. And then the GNSO would make the actual policy recommendation rather than the JIG itself creating the final version. So, you know, it would then inform back to the GNSO before an actual action is taken. So that mechanism was specifically designed so that, you know, even though we have five members each for particular sessions, it does send the sort of final adoption of any report back to the particular separate SOs.
Let me suggest this. Could one or both of you send the list of the official members from the CCNSO and the GNSO? In our case, we're mostly interested in the GNSO, but to the council list. And Wendy raises a good question. There are two new topics that have been added specifically to this group. And so we should be able to see whether there's a way. Obviously, it can happen as an observer status, but if there's someone maybe that's active on the GNSO or that's listed on the GNSO site who maybe is not active, there may be other things that can be done. But let's not take time to resolve that on this call. Can you guys do that?
Yeah, I'll send the list to the council list. But there's one more slot, because I believe, Chuck, you are on the list.
I'm on that strictly because I'm council chair. That's it. So
correct.
You should not include my seat. I have no intentions of being active, just an observer on the outside.
So that does make five, so that on the GNSO side, the group can begin. But it also means that there's one more seat potentially open, because the chairs are by default an alternate or an observer to the group.
So there's room there. Okay.
Yeah. According to what I see, that this is about four representatives from the GNSO and one observer. So there is room to add other representatives of the GNSO, and there is always room for other observers.
Yeah, so, Glenn, I guess what we should do is send out a request to the council with the explanation of, and I'm sure Bart can help you with that, with an explanation of the small expansion to the group. It's really not a real expansion. It sounds like they've already talked about these topics, but and see if there's anyone else that either wants to be an observer or one of the official five, so that it's a broad invitation there, and making clear that as far as official delegates, each SO can only have five. So,
I'll do that. Thank you.
Thanks, Glenn. And I'm sorry, Rafiq and Mike. Rafiq, you're on.
So, hello, I just wanted to say that I want to volunteer.
Oh, thank you. Let's back up a second, because I had asked for volunteers for the developing this new charter. That is no longer a need. You want to participate in this in the jig? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay, that's fine. I just want to clarify because of what I had asked for earlier, I didn't want there to be any confusion. All right, thank you.
As official, not just as observer.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. And you're from the same, so that's very helpful. And you're from the same stakeholder group as Wendy. Wendy, does that at least partially address your concern?
Thanks. Yes, I'd be very happy to get that wider ranging participation.
Okay, thank you. And Mike.
Thanks, Chuck. So I'm assuming that the recommendations in this report on page 7, 4.1, the rules for relaxing the restrictions, these are going to be incorporated into the next version of the draft applicant guidebook?
I don't believe that there's been any final decision on that. Someone from staff want to comment on that? I think there's still action needed in that regard.
Yeah, this is Tina. So if the rules are rounded, two-character rules, then the answer is actually yes. As soon as the comment period is over and we review all of the comments and stuff like that, we feel that the report is so clear that we can take those recommendations and move them into the next version of the applicant guidebook. But if it's 4.1.2, which is the one character rules, then that is what the JIG now will be working on before we do anything else with it.
Thank you, Tina. Yeah. Does that answer your question, Mike?
I got another one. That, wait, Tini, so you said Rule 2 is the one that still needs... Oh, no, 4.1.2. Gotcha, understood. Okay, but 4.1.1 is going in. So, I guess I have some general concerns about the process and how these recommendations have come up kind of outside of the GNSO when they really are GNSO recommendations that these are affecting. But you know, leaving that aside for the moment, I have a question just factually on your Rule 1 in 4.1.1. No visual confusion allows two-character ASCII strings. Okay, that's wonderful, but does that take into account variants in ASCII strings? Like, for example, a lowercase a that can be depicted in any number of, well, in two main different ways, in any number of different fonts?
Fonts are not. The fact that strings can be displayed in various fonts and look the same or similar is not part of this at all. You can make up any kind of font you want, and you can start create problems, right? So fonts are not included, no.
So, okay. Well, I guess, again, I'll just use the example of the lowercase a
mm-hmm.
that has two variants, common variants, I would say.
In what? In ASCII?
Yeah. When I write the letter A, I might write it that looks kind of like an O, or I might write it just with it cut off halfway.
Okay.
Maybe
I don't think those are DNS issues.
No.
When you're looking at visual confusion, the question is, what is your baseline? What's the ASCII baseline?
Right. So fonts are not included in this, and I'll be honest with you and give you a personal opinion on it. If fonts were included, I don't think we would ever be able to solve it. I mean, the number of fonts available out there is enormous, and you could at any point in time make up a new font, and that will create problems. We're not going to get to that level of 100% solution, obviously.
Sure. Well, let me ask you this question. What font is used as a baseline? Courier? Arial?
There is no font specified.
No, there is no font. You know, in certain scripts, you have to actually use specific fonts in order for the string to display right. So if you're writing in Arabic, you might use a different font than if you're writing in English. So there is some font issue to it, but when you look at ASCII only, then no, it's not a font question. And I don't see how you would try to solve that.
Perhaps I'm being dense, but so is it only capital letters? Is it capital letters and lowercase?
It's not case sensitive.
Well,
DNS is not.
Let's get something kind of damp, and then that'll kill the static queen, and you can get it out of there.
Well, it depends on what you're asking. You know, in ASCII, it's not case-sensitive. In IDN, there's a case sensitivity being discussed, and that's in the new version of the protocol. That's a technical issue, and unless you really want to go into detail with it, I'm guessing there, you know, isn't...
I think it should be very clear in the applicant's guidebook what is the baseline that is going to be the comparison for visual confusion. Because I don't know what you say when you say ASCII. Maybe I'm just dense. I don't know what that means.
When I say ASCII, I mean ABC through set, and I mean what it says in Rule 1, 1A and 1B, all possible two-character ASCII codes that are already in the ISO list and any future additions to it. So that means any two-character combinations in ASCII.
And that's LDH, Mike, letter, hyphen, digit.
It's also relevant to Rule 2. Okay, because it's the same thing. You're gonna have to compare ASCII TLDs to non-ASCII and not have visual confusion. So the question is, what is ASCII? Does it include upper and lower case? Is it cursive writing in addition to block writing? You know, these questions are
right. So all of that is the same. It has to be built into the applicant guidebook, right? So, but other than that, it's the same rule that goes into when you compare ASCII against ASCII as when you compare ASCII with IDNs. And there's a couple of things already in place there. Obviously, this is under implementation. But we have the algorithm where you get like a score, a percentage score that is a guidance towards are these two strings confusingly similar or not. And then you have the confusability panel, and I'm sorry, I don't remember exactly what we're calling it, but the panel that will make that determination, right? So initially, we didn't have two characters as GTLDs, and so we didn't have the added opportunity for that. But now, if we follow the and I said it's not final, but if we follow the recommendations in this report, then these kind of rules need to be merged with what already is in place. And for the visual confusion, that's really just the same thing.
Okay, because we're running out of time for our agenda, I'm going to move on to Alan and then move on to the next agenda item. Alan, did you have your hand raised?
Yeah, I did have. I was trying to rephrase what Michael was asking in a different, slightly different form. I think what he's asking is if a character in Russian is claimed to look like a P or like an R,
mm-hmm.
which one are you comparing it to? Because in his case of a lowercase a, lowercase a's can look radically different from each other, so what is the standard that you're using for what an ASCII character looks like?
Oh,
that does depend on font, so I think the question is valid.
Yeah, so it does depend on the font, on when it looks the same, but I wasn't trying to say that one character can only have one other variant. It can certainly have many. So it could be, if it looks both like a P and like an R, then it would be compared to both.
Yeah, no, I think the question he was asking, and I think it's a valid one, is ICANN going to publish what ASCII characters are using as the norm to compare the other scripts to?
So what font we're displaying ASCII in before we compare it? I'll have to look at the algorithm to see what they do, and obviously this is a panel work item as well. So.
Yeah.
And that sounds like an implementation issue, Kurt. So hopefully you're taking notes. So,
yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks, Tina, very much, and everybody else for the discussion on that topic. Going now to the item 5, the AdGrace Grid Limits Policy Implementation Report. That's been out for quite a while now. It came out, I think, just before our last meeting. But too late to discuss in that meeting. And Craig Schwartz has a brief presentation on that I think will show up on the Adobe Connect, as well as there's a link there on the agenda. Go ahead, Craig.
Thanks, Chuck. And as you mentioned, the AGP report came out back in December before the holidays, so it has been around for a little bit of time. I actually am not able to connect to Adobe right now, but I do have the slide in front of me, so what I'll do is just speak to them briefly.
And we have it in front of us, Craig.
Okay,
so.
Great. So as most folks know, for the majority of the registries, the AGP policy went into effect on April 1st. Some registries opted to start a month early. Other registries asked for a 30-day delay. But all the registries that are required to implement AGP now are doing so, and so the policy has been in effect for 9 months. It's been well documented and well publicized that domain tasting has almost nearly been eliminated, reduced by 99.7% since the inception of the budget provision, followed by the AGP limits policy itself. There is a provision in the policy for registrars to request an exemption from the prohibition of the refund of their registration fee from the registries under cases of extraordinary circumstances. And since the policy went into effect, there have been 9 such requests. And details of the requests, including the TLD, the month that the request was made, the registrar's name, and the basis for the request, are all documented in the report itself as one of the 2 appendices. As you see, bullet number 4 says that 66% of the requests cite fraud as the basis, and the requests that have been made where fraud is the basis have not been approved by registry operators that have rendered a decision on an exemption request. So if you go to the second slide, when we talk about possible next steps, the GNSO recommendation itself, I believe it's item 2, part B, says that...
Just one second, Craig. Can we go to the second slide? on Adobe?
You can scroll down yourself.
Oh, I can? Okay. I was just waiting. Okay.
Are you
go ahead.
Sure. So what you don't have in front of you is the GNSO recommendation on domain casing, but part two, item B says the purpose of monitoring requirements are to allow the GNSO to determine when, if ever, these recommendations and any ensuing policy require additional clarification or attention based on the results of the reports prepared by ICANN staff. So what's on the slide itself talks about possible next steps, and what those are is a consideration of any future modifications given the registrar complaints that have been made to both registry operators and to ICANN, and the possibility that the GNSO might consider defining or adding clarity to some of the terminology in the policy recommendation itself. So I think the complaints that we've received are provided in the report, as well as possible next steps. ICANN staff will continue to provide these update reports twice a year, and continue to provide additional information about other exemption requests that we get. So I guess we could open the floor to any questions that folks might have. I think that there's probably been some discussion on this issue of fraud potentially being a legitimate use of the AGP, but it's not something that was actually built into the policy or into the implementation notes.
And thank you, Craig. Any questions or comments?
I see Mike. I think it was. Fraud was considered, obviously, as a potentially legitimate use of the AGP by the domain tasting group and by our policy recommendations. That's why we had the 10% threshold to allow a certain amount of so-called free to leave. So I don't understand what the real issue is, or certainly why it's urgent, or why council would consider taking it up right now anyway.
Well, the question, Mike, is whether or not are you saying that you think registries should automatically accept requests that are based on fraud, exemptions
registry
that are based on fraud?
I don't think so. No, I think the registrar.
Oh, okay. That's what I was clarifying. Okay, you answered my question. I wasn't clear on what direction you were going. Now I am.
Chuck, this is Craig. So we have to also remember too that there's the threshold that the policy permits the 10% of net new registrations, or 50, which is ever higher, for each TLD. So there is a built-in cushion for a certain amount of fraudulent activity. You know, I've never worked for a registry, so I don't know what a reasonable or normal amount of fraudulent registrations are on a monthly basis. But I think the threshold set at 10% was done so for very specific reasons.
Okay, Alan.
Yeah, I agree with Mike that when we discussed this in the group, fraud was certainly one of the reasons that we had a cushion there. I guess my reaction to your question is I wouldn't expect a registry to automatically do it, but I also wouldn't necessarily think that it's automatically refused because the explanation is fraud.
I understand.
I'm just a little worried if that fraud is a key word which says it will be refused as opposed to the actual conditions considered.
Yeah, I don't think that's the case. But so if what I said implied that, I'm sorry.
Alan, this is Craig again. Within the policy itself, it does say that registry operators can make decisions or have the authority to make decisions at their sole reasonable discretion. So there's nothing that says that they can't approve exemption requests where fraud is the basis. I mean, there is the language that says that exemption requests that recur regularly are not considered extraordinary. So you could potentially say that if a particular registrar is reporting, you know, excessive fraud month after month after month, that's not necessarily an extraordinary circumstance, but it would sound like that registrar might have, you know, problems that need to be dealt with, you know, at an operational level.
Okay. Christina.
I was just going to note that if the council does want to pick this up at some point, particularly with regard to the fraud point, that I would think it would be helpful first to find out, to the extent that we could, why those registries that may have denied exemption requests on the grounds of where the ground provided was fraud did so. Again, if we're not going to look at this right now, there's no need to, you know, do anything
about it. Yeah, gotcha. So, Mike, do you still have your hand up? It's still up in Adobe, I guess not. Okay. The question for us then is there interest, and we don't necessarily have to make this decision right now. If not, we probably should in the next meeting. Is there interest in taking up the topics on the second slide here? In particular, is there interest in defining extraordinary circumstances further, or trying to do that, or what does reoccur, you know, exemption requests reoccurring regularly mean? Is there interest in doing that, Alan?
Well, two comments. First of all, I'll note we really don't have any process other than starting a new PDP to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Ignoring that, I would have some interest in discussions with registries to understand the issue before council would make a decision whether we actually put real work into it, given the overall workload. So, you know, that may require, you know, sort of unofficial discussions if there are things that they don't want to disclose in public. But I think the issue needs to be understood more before we decide to that we're actually going to undertake policy development on it.
Craig, could you serve as kind of the interface there to explore that further for those on the council that would like to get a little more information?
Sure.
Okay. So, Alan and Christina, too, if you want to interact with Craig in that regard and get more information. And let me suggest that at any point, if anyone or any constituency or stakeholder group wants to a NOMCOM member or whatever wants to put something forward with regard to pursuing that further, I certainly recommend that you do that. Anything else on this topic before we move on? Tim?
No, thanks, Jeff. Now, I was just going to respond to your first question, and that I don't think it's something we need to pursue right now. I mean, just looking at the report, unless there's data not being shown there, such as other complaints about other aspects of it from registrars. I mean, there's six registrars that requested exemptions, and a couple of those were granted, and one was partially granted and others weren't, and the ones that weren't were mostly pretty small numbers. So I don't see any huge issue on the horizon that says we need to look at this anytime soon.
Thank you. Okay, and again, the door's open if somebody thinks we get to a point where that's needed for that to happen. In the meantime, those that would like to try and get a little more information before making that decision, if you'll interface with Craig, we can do that. Moving quickly then to item six, the status updates, I'll turn it over to Han Chuan and Olga regarding items of interest for the CCNSO. Which one of you would like to be first?
Chuck, I would like to mention something.
Okay.
Thank you. I don't know if Bart is already still in the call. The CCNSO is setting up an ad hoc study group on wildcards. I know some of the council members have been asking about this. It's now calling for volunteers to this group. So I have already sent the detailed information to Glenn and a link to a PDF document. So if someone is interested in volunteering, just not let me, but let the CCNSO people know. The CCNSO Council has appointed Yonuk M. Lee and Andre Philippe to co-chair this group.
Thank you, Olga. And has that been sent to the council list?
I sent it to
our press to the council list, Chuck.
Thank you.
Thank you, Glenn.
Han Chuan, anything to add?
Han Chuan is not on the call.
He's not.
Chat.
Thank you very much, Glenn. Appreciate that. Okay. Any other status updates that need to be made that weren't submitted in writing? And note that because of the holidays, a lot of the status updates weren't updated for the various groups this time, but I appreciate those who did anyway. Are there any questions or comments regarding those that were submitted? Under any other business, item 7, staff update on plans to ensure safety and security in Nairobi. Has someone yet been identified to talk about that?
This is Denise, Chuck.
Okay.
Jeff Bickers handles security for ICANN under the direction of Greg Rattray. He indicated to policy staff that they do not have any specific additional information beyond what they have already disseminated at this time. He also asked me to convey that ICANN will not be ensuring attendee safety, of course, while at the meeting. And as with any international travel, Nairobi is a venue with inherent risks, and individual attendees should weigh before deciding to attend. He also noted that it would be helpful to have the GNSO Council or broader GNSO community members to provide any specific concerns or questions that they may have to Jeff and Greg, and that would allow them to provide more useful briefing at a later date. He did indicate that that they prepared the summary of security activities, which the CEO is reviewing, and the intention is to provide more details on security arrangements at a later date.
Well, Denise, first of all, it seems to me that some questions I've already seen raised that still haven't been clearly answered are the transportation between the airport and the hotels, and between hotels and the meetings and the detail at the meeting venue and the details of that. So those have already been raised, and I think there are still questions in people's minds in terms of what is really being provided there. The statement that was provided previously was not specific in terms of what was provided there. Was it transportation from the airport to the hotels, or just the hotels to the venue, et cetera? So those have been raised, but I certainly encourage everyone to raise additional questions that you have, and we have two people in the queue here. Tim.
Yeah, that was, I guess, what I wanted to point out, too, in particular from the hotel, from the airport to the hotel. Given that, like, for example, from the U.S., there's, depending on where you're at, the only flights available end up getting you into Nairobi, like, at 9:30 at night or something. And so, you know, concerns about arranging safe transportation from the airport to the hotel, and wondering if ICANN is going to provide any of that. So that was my question.
Thank you, Tim. Christina.
Tim asked my question, so I'm going to lower my hand.
Okay, Alan.
Yeah, I'll just reiterate that we can make private reservations, but if we don't find out till too late that ICANN or the local host are not providing transportation, it may be too late to do it properly at that point. And similarly, between the hotels and the meeting venue, you know, it would be good to have an assurance that there will, any time the meeting venue is open, there will be buses going around with good frequency. It doesn't sound like too much to ask.
Yeah, and the previous communication was not clear on that with enough detail, I think, for people's benefit. So, again, you know, I think asking for those kinds of questions that have already been asked, again, is unfortunate, and that I would have hoped by now we would have had answers on those things. If there are additional questions that come up, let's please communicate them, so that Denise can work with the security staff and get specific answers.
Chuck, to follow up, the suggestion that we have to make our own decisions about whether to go or not is exactly what we're trying to do.
Good point. Okay. All right.
Chuck, if I may.
Yes, you may.
The, of course, policy staff really has no
purview, I understand,
or knowledge in this area, but we're happy to relay this once again, as we did previously, the specific concerns about transport to the hotels and from the hotels, from the airport and from the hotels to the venue. And Glenn will make sure that all council members have the email address of Jeff Vickers and Greg Rattray, and we would encourage you to share any additional questions or concerns that you have directly with them. But I will, again, pass these on to them.
Thank
you. They do have a more detailed security information with Rod Beckstrom, sort of awaiting approval, and they do have plans providing more information in the near future.
Thank you. Going on to agenda item 7.
It's
yes?
Christina. I'm sorry. Does staff know at this point where hotel-supported GNSO counselors are going to be staying?
Good question.
Good question. I don't know if Glenn does.
This is Glenn. Not to the best of my knowledge as yet, but I think there has been an hotel allocated, but I can't tell you which one. I don't.
So that's another question to add to the list. Thank
you. Along with that question is, I mean, I'm not staying anywhere but the Intercontinental. So if staff puts counselors anywhere else, you know, that's still where I'm going to stay. I already have a reservation there. But, you know, in that case, will there be reimbursement to some extent for the charges, and you know, how will that be arranged?
One more question. So, again, Denise, we don't expect your answer to that right now, but
I noted that, and I'll I think the hotel allocation question goes to the meeting staff, and so I'll
right.
make sure that Nick Tomaso is aware that this question needs to be responded to.
Okay, thank you. All right, going on then to agenda item 7, any other business, and we have the second part of that, which is the draft proposal for the affirmation of commitments, review teams. It's linked there, a couple links provided. And then, Denise, you were going to give a brief overview of that. Be as brief as possible because we're over time.
So I would direct you to the excellent summary that Chuck Gomes has provided, which also includes a link to the actual affirmation of commitments document. I'll give the briefest of overviews and then turn it over to Marco, who is facilitating the public comment process and proposed plans for actually implementing the reviews under the affirmation of commitments. And Marco will give you a very brief summary of the draft proposal that's out for public comment. On September 30th of last year, ICANN and the U.S. Department of Commerce signed the affirmation of commitment agreement. This is a long-standing agreement with no limit. It replaces the previous joint partnership agreements and, before that, the memorandum of understanding that ICANN and the Department of Commerce had previously entered into. It provides commitments and affirms commitments on the part of both ICANN and the Department of Commerce, and specifically commitments to ensure that decisions made related to global technical coordination of the GNS are made in the public interest and are accountable and transparent, also to preserve the stability and resiliency of the DNS, and to promote competition, consumer trust, consumer choice in the DNS marketplace, and finally, to facilitate international participation in domain name technical issues. It delineates very specific recognitions and responsibilities for both the U.S. Department of Commerce and for ICANN. And it lays out specifically a series of reviews that are required, community-led reviews to assess progress and fulfillment of these commitments. These reviews focus on four performance areas: One is accountability and transparency. This review is due to be completed, delivered in this calendar year. The second is security and stability and resilience. The third review, competition, consumer trust and consumer choice. And finally, the fourth review is who is. The plan that's been, the proposed plan that's been posted for public comment provides a draft process structure to carry out these reviews. The board of directors asked staff to come up with a draft plan, reviewed it, and asked them to post it for public comment. I'll turn it over to Marco now to provide a brief summary of what is posted. I would encourage all council members who have not done so to review this draft. Marco?
Okay, thanks, Denise. Thanks, Chuck, and good evening, everybody. It's very difficult to add something to the excellent summary that is provided by Chuck a few days ago. Basically, the draft proposal that is now up for public comments is organized in five different sections. First of all, you will see a very short preamble that contains the requirements of the affirmation of commitment in the area of reviews. Then you have a second section, just four pages, focusing on a proposed methodology for conducting the review. In particular, there is some attention on the nine phases that make up the review processes and that are proposed for public comment. A third section focuses on the preliminary activities, so those activities that have to be done before the actual starting of the review processes. As Denise just reminded, the first of those reviews, the one on accountability and transparency, is due to be finished by the end of this year. So it's very crucial as a preliminary activity to set up immediately review teams for the the review team for the carrying out of this first review. So a big part of the attention of the Section 3 of this report on preliminary activity focuses, in fact, on proposals, on ideas for public comments on how to set up the review teams. On this, there are some very clear requirements that are contained in the affirmation of commitment, such as the review teams that are responsible for carrying out the reviews must be composed of volunteer community members in representation of the relevant supporting organizations and advisory committees. So in giving application to this very clear request, the paper tries to envisage processes and proposes some ideas about the possible size and composition of the review team. Other activities are explained, other preliminary activities are proposed for discussion in this Section 3, which is concluded by a very brief identification of the budget for the reviews. The two last sections of the paper are one is just a simple timeline in a Gantt chart form, which highlights the preparatory activities and the first review, and finally there is a draft terms of reference for the first review. So once again, having in mind the requirement of the affirmation of commitment. It's very important, I think, to see what are the present steps and the very next steps for passing to implementation and to make the review teams able to proceed quickly with the first review activities. The draft proposal is up for public comment till the end of January, and contemporary. In a week or 10 days, as it has been announced already by Yanis Karklins, the two persons that will be in charge of the selection of the team members for the first team, so the GAC chair and the board chair, will announce a call for volunteer community members to apply through their supporting organizations or advisory committees for this possibility. This should be this process in the intention of the proposal that is up for public comments should be finished by the end of February, in order to have the review team, the first review team, set up and in place for Nairobi, in order for them to start the meeting. I would like to conclude here because time is very short, but I'm fully available for any kind of question on the process that drove us on this and any kind of request on the specific content of this paper.
Now, thank you very much, Marco and Denise. I have one question. Now, I have raised this question in the last week with Yanis, because Yanis initiated discussion with the chairs of the SOs and ACs. And this idea of Yanis and Peter coming out with a request for statements of interest, it's unless I'm misunderstanding something, it seems to me that they're bypassing the SOs and the ACs in terms of selecting the volunteers via those organizations. Am I missing something, or is that a correct conclusion on my part?
I think that it is a link to give application to the requirement of the affirmation of commitment. Volunteer members of the community has to be designated by supporting organizations and advisory committees indeed. So volunteers have to be sponsored, supported, or in any case to apply through their supporting organizations and advisory committees. Just in those days, we will exchange some preparatory draft for a text for a call for applicants, in which the principle would be underlined that applicants should go through their supporting organizations and advisory committees, because this is the letter of the affirmation of commitment.
So the intent is still that they be endorsed by their supporting organization or AC. But the expression of interest will be open to the broader community. So anybody, for example, in the GNSO community could submit an expression of interest to participate on the accountability and transparency review team, and then they would and then it would be up to them or the council to endorse them.
Yes, to endorse them or not. Another specific aspect that will be requested in order to disclose in a very transparent way the applications, any applicant will be very likely requested to submit a short resume and a sort of a motivation letter. And the idea is to go public with the resumes and motivation letters from applicants in order to give visibility to the whole community on people that volunteer for the membership in the review team. This giving also application to the other requirement of the affirmation, which is to go for disclosure and comment on the composition of the review team.
Will the potential candidates be restricted to those who submit expressions of interest, or do you know that answer?
Sorry, I didn't get your...
Okay, so there's a request coming out from Yanis and Peter for expressions of interest for being on the review team for accountability and transparency. Does someone have to submit an expression of interest to be eligible?
The requirement will be necessarily a bit vague, because eligibility will be definitely restrained to people with sound knowledge of ICANN and our working environment, availability to working team, availability to analytical skills, availability to analyze data, and so on and so forth. This is the kind of skill set that is advisable to require in this kind of call for volunteer application.
Alan?
Yeah, it's still unclear to me if four people apply for one slot, all of whom have the knowledge, all of whom belong to the community, does the GNSO have to decide which of the four goes, or does the GNSO have the option of endorsing all of them and then someone else makes the pick? It's not clear who's making the decision.
Well, it's clear in the doc in the AOC who makes the decision. The chair of the ICANN board and the chair of the GAC make the decision. But the other part of your question, the GNSO, in the case of whatever representative or representatives come from the GNSO community, would be able to endorse or not endorse candidates.
But that implies the GNSO may endorse several, and then...
Yes, I think so.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's true. It doesn't mean that we have to, if there's only one GNSO candidate, it doesn't mean we only have to endorse one. Yeah, I think that's absolutely true.
Yeah, and there is also another reason for this, which is the size of the review team that has not been decided yet. There is a proposal up for public comments, and the proposal is very much focused on small review teams. But public comments could ask for a different approach. So the only way to run in parallel the two processes, so the public consultation and the call for applicants, is to open, so to require ASOs and AACs to provide candidates without indication on the number of candidates from each supporting organization and advisory committees, because this will very much depend on the result of the public comment phase.
Yes. Bill.
Yeah, hi. I have a little bit of concern about one of the assumptions in the report about the size of the teams. It says that there's no doubt that the review team should be kept small, and this is self-evident, confirmed by the literature on group dynamics. It seems to me that's a kind of narrow reading of the literature. And, you know, if you take a broader sample of relevant literature, I think you'd find that, in fact, size alone is utterly indeterminate predictor of whether a group is going to be effective. I mean, there's a lot of other literature, such as international negotiations, that often point in opposite directions, that larger groups allow for more tactical linking of issues, exchange of side payments, et cetera, and a lot of small groups don't work well. They deadlock as well. So I think it's generally speaking a wash. Also, it seems to me that the literature that they cite in the report in support of this argument is insensitive to the kind of environment we're in here, with a lot of international and sectoral diversity of interests being represented in the GNSO. So I'm not convinced that one person from, you know, one stakeholder group would necessarily be able to fully reflect the range of GNSO views or draw on the special expertise of the range of people we've got involved here, et cetera. It just seems to me that that's highly problematic. I guess I'd say one other thing, too. Many of us have real-world experience with larger groups that work effectively and make decisions, including here. So it's not necessary to me to have a small and unrepresentative group, and I think this is really inconsistent with the whole community support orientation of the AOC. I'd like to see two GNSO counselors in each group from different stakeholder groups, and I'd like to see, I'd suggest that maybe if others agree that the GNSO might provide a comment to that effect. There's one other question. We have to sort out amongst ourselves what the coordination would be between the council and any people that we have on the council, whether they're acting on the teams, whether they're acting as representatives or just independent experts with their own mandate ideas and so on. So in general, I'd like to hear some discussion from people about whether they agree that this should be a tiny little group of people.
Olga.
Yes, thank you, Chuck. I would like to support what Bill said, and I think I already submitted a comment to our email list, and I think we should make a comment to have more GNSO representation in this review team. So I'm happy to help in a drafting team.
Okay. Now, so that's one of the questions on the agenda. Do we want to submit some comments or a comment or however we want to devise it in response to the request for comments on this? And we don't need to decide what we're going to comment on right now. If so, we need to devise a plan for making that happen in the next few weeks. So is there I've heard at least two people, Bill and Olga, suggest that we should submit some comments or a comment. Anybody disagree with that? And Bill, do you still have your hand up?
No, sorry.
Okay, that's okay. I just want to confirm. Okay, nobody disagrees with that. So now we have to devise a plan for developing those comments, and we've used the drafting team model, which seems to work pretty well. Olga has volunteered to be part of a drafting team there. Does anybody else want to join Olga?
I'd be willing to.
Okay, Bill. Anyone else?
Caroline, I'd be willing to join.
Caroline, okay.
Mm-hmm.
And Glenn, you can put it out to the list so somebody else wants to join. But we have three people, and what I'd like to ask the three of you to do, and anybody else that volunteers, to select your own lead person, however you want to devise that, so that there's a coordinating contact point. Unfortunately, this really has to be jumped on right away, because we're going to have to get any suggestions you have in front of the council well before the 28th January meeting, so that we can discuss it. Now, the second issue we have on this is, okay, how do we endorse candidates? That's an interesting thing, and there are lots of corollary questions that need to be dealt with. Bill raised some of those with regard to, is this person supposed to be a representative of the GNSO community, or persons representatives of the GNSO community, or are they there to specifically perform a well-defined review process based on criteria that are well-defined and measurable? Those we won't have time to debate right now, but we should talk about on our list, and so in the next week or two. Those of you who are volunteering, do you want to take on that task as well, or should we consider that as a separate task? Because it is quite different. Thoughts?
I think we could address that as well. That'd be one.
Anybody opposed to that? Okay. Thanks. I appreciate that. So, is it unrealistic to ask the three of you and anybody else who volunteers to get something back to the, I know it's very short notice, but something back to the council, even if it's very preliminary and draft, outline even in a week? That's what I'd like to suggest, so that, because unfortunately this whole thing, especially for this first review, has to be done in terribly short order, which is difficult. So,
a week,
okay,
for me is difficult, Chuck, with travel. But if others will take the lead, I can try.
Okay. All right. It's not a set-in-stone thing, but do the best you can, because by the time a week goes by, and then we're now 2 weeks within the next council meeting, and, you know, it goes by very fast. So, and to give people a chance to review things with their constituencies and stakeholder groups, it just doesn't leave much time, and the comment period ends the end of this month. So, in the meantime, I'll keep you informed of my dialogue with Giannis on this issue, and see what I get back on that. So, now,
Chuck, it's Carolyn here, just to clarify. Sorry, so we're coming up with draft comments on behalf of the GNSO, and then some sort of model for selecting a representative?
I suggest we don't call them representatives. We don't know whether they're going to be representative of us or not. They may be their review team members who come from our community. So to keep the controversy out of what their task is, as Bill appropriately raised the question, you know, let's just call them review team members from the GNSO.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, yeah, that answer your question?
Mm-hmm,
okay.
It does, thanks.
Okay, good. All right, and thanks for the volunteers in that regard. Now, and I apologize for the length of the meeting, but we keep getting these time-sensitive things that need to be handled. Real quickly, we can have more discussion on the list, but the joint meeting with the GAC in Nairobi, Giannis has suggested two topics, which, in my personal opinion, seem to be reasonable topics for us to talk about with the GAC, the EOI, the GTLD implementation policy, including that, and the affirmation of commitments that we're talking about right now. Does anybody on the call right now object to either of these topics for possible topics for our joint meeting with the GAC and GNSO?
This is Stefan.
Yes, Stefan.
You may not be seeing this, but on the Adobe, people are starting to drop off and saying that we should take this discussion to the list.
Okay. We're obviously going to have to do that. Does anybody have anybody that's still on the call, does anybody have an objection to those two topics? Okay. And please feel free to suggest additional topics in that regard, if we want to add that. You can't do much in an hour, so keep that in mind. Glenn, let's follow this one up with a request, some specific questions. I'll help draft them, and we'll get it out to the but give me an action item in that regard.
I'll do that.
With regard to following up on this. Any questions or comments on the project status list? Okay, I want to thank Marika for managing the Adobe Connect for us, and for all the everyone that contributed in this meeting and participated. And without further ado, I will adjourn the meeting. Sorry for the lateness.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye.